Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 1, The Phantom Red Menace. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades. Welcome to the show. If you're wondering who I am and what we're doing here, I highly suggest going back to the introduction episode for more detail. But basically, this is a podcast about the history of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the first state formed with the explicit goal of building a society founded on socialist principles, told from a socialist perspective. And, as I mentioned in that episode, this and the following few episodes are going to be laying the groundwork for our understanding of the USSR. I apologize in advance for the theory-heavy start, but there's just no way around it. We need to do some reading. All right, are we all buckled in? Great. First up, what exactly is a Marxism? Now, I'm going to level with you all. I rewrote this episode at least a half dozen times. The issue I kept having was trying to keep this introduction to Marxism from spiraling into a five-hour lecture. Marx's corpus of work is vast. He had a lot to say, and not all of it was just on political economy. And I'm not even going to pretend to have read it all. But since we're trying to achieve liftoff here for a new podcast that is not Marxism 101, we're going to keep this introduction focused on the two following questions: why socialism, and why workers? In answering why socialism, we will be exploring the role socialism has in Marx's conception of history. In answering why workers, we'll examine why he believed the workers, the laborers, the proletarians, were so crucial to achieving socialism. We are limiting our examination of Marxism to these two topics because they are, I think, the two most relevant aspects of Marx's thought to the project at hand. But just know that there's a lot more Marx had to say about a lot of different topics. And even when it comes to answering these two questions, we are barely going to scratch the surface of the tip of the iceberg. But first, who was Karl Marx? He was born in Trier, Prussia, modern-day Germany, on the 5th of May, 1818. His father, Heinrich Marx, was a lawyer. His mother, Henrietta Pressburg, was the daughter of a rabbi. Karl studied philosophy and was heavily influenced by the German philosopher Hegel. He received his doctorate in 1841, and in 1843 he both joined the Communist League of Europe and married Jenny von Westphalen, with whom he had, by all accounts, a dedicated and loving marriage. The two would go on to have six children, although only three would survive into adulthood. In 1844, he partnered with the man with whom he would share a deep and abiding friendship and ideological collaboration for the rest of his life, Friedrich Engels. Truly, in the history of best friend duos, Marx and Engels are indisputably in the top tier, right alongside Frodo and Sam, or Han and Chewie. Engels was born in Barmen, Germany, on the 28th of November, 1820, and was the son of a wealthy textile mill owner. However, Engels ultimately turned his back on the idea of continuing his father's capitalist enterprise, and instead dedicated himself to the development of socialist theory. Starting in 1844, for the rest of their lives, Marx and Engels would be partners in every sense of the word. They were so close that Engels often used his inheritance to support the Marxes as they struggled to make a living, bouncing around continental Europe and England. Engels would frequently either finish or edit Marx's work uncredited, because they were practically of one mind about everything. But make no mistake, he wrote plenty of his own works, works which are definitely worth reading every bit as Marx's. Together and separately, they wrote extensively on their ideas about history and philosophy, as well as the events of their times. They provided deep insights into the revolutions in Europe in 1848, the Paris Commune, even the U.S. Civil War. And of course, the three volumes of Das Kapital are probably the most famous of their works. When Marx died on the 3rd of March, 1883, only volume one of his magnum opus had been published. Engels picked up the baton and finished the remaining two volumes before his own passing on the 5th of August, 1895. Well, I hope you enjoyed those biographies of the founders of an entire ideology, because that's all the time we have for them. So let's turn to our first question. Why socialism? Or, to rephrase it more intelligibly, why, according to Marx, is socialism the next step in human economic and social evolution? The answer lies in Marx's conception of history, historical materialism. Marx's broader philosophy of how the world works is called dialectical materialism. In this phrase, dialectical means that everything is constantly acting on everything else and being acted on at the same time. Everything is changing and being changed simultaneously. Nothing is static and permanent. Change is the only constant. In other words, dialectical means simply the interplay of all the different forces in question and how they act upon each other and are changed by that interaction. Materialism here means that the physical world which we experience through our senses is what is real, as opposed to an abstract and unobserved spiritual or theological world. Reality is literally material made up of physical matter. There's no need to appeal to the spiritual, the divine, or the metaphysical when posing questions about human behavior. The stuff, the material, provides the answers one is looking for. So put them together, and dialectical materialism really just boils down to the physical material world is what is real, and it is constantly changing as all its composite elements interact with each other. Humans are an integral part of that world. We do not stand above or outside nature. It is us, and we are it. A famous practical example of this was Marx and Engels' reaction to Charles Darwin's work, specifically his theory of evolution. When Origin of Species was published, arguing that living organisms are both shaped by their environment and shape the environment in turn, they both basically jumped up and down, pointing at it, saying, "See, see, that's what we mean." When Marx applied his general philosophy of dialectical materialism to a study of human society, he gave us historical materialism. Since society is the way in which humans organize themselves to meet their material needs, and since the material conditions in which people do this are constantly changing, society itself is also constantly changing. Humans act on the world around them and are also being acted upon by it. And as various societies come into contact with each other, people enact change on others and are themselves changed. Before we go any further, I'm afraid we have to get some things in order. You see, we are about to get into Marx's conceptual organization of human economic activity, what he called society's economic base. But it is more than a little technical, so to really understand it, I'm going to walk us through a flowchart of terms that Marxists use on a daily basis when talking about both the economy and society. These terms are so important to everything Marx, so please feel free to grab paper and pen and follow along. Starting on level one of our flowchart, we have two separate entries. First, there are the instruments of labor. These are the literal tools used to create something. Whether we're talking about a hammer, a blowtorch, or a deep-sea oil rig, we humans use these instruments of labor to shape the world around us to meet our needs. The other entry on level one is the objects of labor. These are the raw materials upon which the instruments of labor are enacted. So the wood which the hammer nails together, or the material the blowtorch welds, or the earth through which the oil rig drills to get to the oil, even the oil itself. These are all examples of objects of labor. Now put a plus sign between these two entries and draw a line connecting each of them to a single entry on the next level of the flowchart. The instruments of labor plus the objects of labor equal a term I'm sure many of you have heard before, and I promise you will hear many times in this show. The means of production. The means of production are simply everything, both tools and raw materials, used to produce anything to be used by humans. In the modern world, this includes land, raw materials such as gold, oil, and lumber, artificial structures such as office buildings and car factories, tools such as saws, steam engines, plows, and lathes, vehicles such as planes, trains, and automobiles, even advanced tech like computer servers and drones. Literally everything we use to provide for our material needs and keep our society functioning. Still on this second level, we draw a plus sign adding to the means of production a new entry, human labor. Since the means of production are themselves inanimate, unless, of course, you're living in the world of Fantasia, they require an outside force to act upon them to create something. That outside force is human labor. Otherwise, the means of production lie fallow. A common objection to Marx's conception of human labor is that he focuses too much on manual labor. And while that certainly is the kind of labor to which he alludes most often, in Marx's defense, he does, of course, recognize intellectual labor as intrinsic to the functioning of society. But whether it is physical or intellectual, as we will see, human labor is very, very special. A quick side note here before moving on. I am using the term human labor to keep things basic, but it is incredibly important to note that Marx lived in the time of mechanized and automated production and was acutely aware of its impact on all aspects of society. He dedicated 140 pages and, if I'm not mistaken, the longest chapter in Capital Volume 1 to describing the effect of mechanization and automation of production on human society. It is chapter 15 if you want to go look it up yourself. Unfortunately, I simply do not have time to go into it here, but I did not want to leave anyone who is new to this scratching their head thinking, hey, wait a minute, we have AI now. What does human labor have to do with anything anymore? If you want the answer to that question, go read chapter 15 of Capital Volume 1. Okay, back to our chart. On level 2, we have means of production plus human labor. But what does that equal? Now we can draw two lines connecting each of these concepts to level 3 of our flowchart. Means of production plus human labor equals forces of production. The forces of production are everything internal and external to humans that humans use to meet material needs and reproduce their society. And when Marxists talk about reproducing society, all we mean is literally making sure we are all able to get up in the morning and do this again. It's about ensuring that the group can go on living in order to birth and raise the next generation so that they can go on living, and so on. Now, just like before, we're going to add something new on this level. So we make another plus sign and add to the forces of production the relations of production. This entry includes the sum total of all relations into which people, on both an individual and a societal level, enter with others in order to reproduce themselves and their society. Examples would be relations between master and slave, landlord and serf, employer and employee, gender, sexual, and domestic relations, even the cooperation and competition between groups of laborers. Any kind of economic relationship or relationship tangentially related to economic production falls under the term relations of production. And finally, we come to the top of our flowchart. Draw a final pair of lines joining the forces of production and the relations of production into level 4, the mode of production. The totality of how humans function economically. How we build our houses, grow our food, operate our machines. How we raise and educate our children. How we relate to each other sexually. And how we structure our families. And how we relate to each other as fellow human beings in pursuit of common economic goals. In other words, the mode of production is the economic base of a society. Now that we've got a flow chart and a glossary of Marxist terms, we can get back to the fun stuff, historical materialism. Modes of production were central to historical materialism. In analyzing economic activity throughout history, Marx identified 5 distinct modes of production. These are 1, primitive communism, 2, the ancient mode of production, 3, feudalism, 4, capitalism, and 5, communism. It was these modes of production, and specifically the one in which he lived, capitalism, that really interested Marx most of all in his writings on political economy. Remember, he's a materialist, and an economic mode of production is really all about how humans pursue the goal of satisfying their various material needs and wants. You can't get more materialist than that. Primitive communism corresponds to what we now call hunter-gatherer tribes. Humans lived in groupings of roughly 100 to 200 people, working together toward the common goal of survival of the group. The tools that were used were crude and primitive, but were owned in common. There was no distinction here of slave and master, or business owner and hired hand. There were recognized leaders, individuals who were looked to for guidance, wisdom, or to settle disputes. But there existed no mechanism of enforcing any sort of compulsion or systemic violence against other members of the group. Human societies at this time may have been sociologically more developed than is often thought, but technologically they were rather basic. And so a group's ability to meet the material needs of its members would have required almost daily toil. Side note, daily toil here does not mean toil the entire day. It has been fairly well established in recent decades that hunter-gatherers spent far fewer hours a week doing what we would recognize as work than we spend today. A little bit of work would have been needed each day, hence daily toil, but this could be done in concentrated bursts of labor for a total average of 4 to 5 hours a day. The rest of the time, people were communing, relaxing, playing, sleeping. Something to think about when you're clocking in for your next 12-hour shift, or racing across town to get to your second job on time. Check out Marshall Saline's 1972 book, Stone Age Economics, if you're interested in learning more. Eventually, the forces of labor were developed enough to allow human society to evolve out of primitive communism. And when that happened, we find the first division of society into classes, a division which persists to this very day. Class is obviously a central idea to Marx's entire political economy. This is another instance of oversimplifying Marx in the interest of keeping things moving, but the most basic definition of class in Marxism is a group's relationship to the means of production. Throughout human history, we see that there are two main groups, a minority of owners of the means of production, and the majority dependent on them for their access to the means of production in order to provide for themselves. Individuals may drift in and out of these groups over time, and what the groups call themselves also changes, but the classes themselves have persisted. Of course, lest anyone out there try to accuse Marx of being overly simplistic, he recognized that human society was much more complex than just these two classes. There have always been those subgroups and individuals who did not fall neatly into either of these two camps. But this does not change the fact that for the last 12,000 years of human history, give or take a millennium, society has been cleaved along this basic distinction: the owners and everyone else, the haves and the have-nots. And as Marx opens the Communist Manifesto, quote, "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles," end quote. The first classes arose when humanity entered the ancient mode of production. This corresponds to the first known civilizations of the ancient world: Babylon, Egypt, Greece, and Rome. The basic class division here was that of master and slave, which is why the term ancient mode of production is used interchangeably with slave mode of production. Slavery took different forms throughout history. For the American audience, it might help to understand that slavery in Greece or Rome was quite different from the chattel slavery of the first 250 years of European presence in North America. It's not that slaves in the ancient world lived well, but at various times and in various places, they had at least some legal protections and rights, and were even sometimes generally recognized as people, not property. This is, of course, completely different from the enslavement of the people of Africa, who were kidnapped and forcibly had themselves and their offspring turned into legal property to be disposed of by their owners as the latter saw fit. Eventually, slavery gave way to feudalism. This corresponds roughly to the period of late antiquity and the collapse and fall of the Western Roman Empire in most of Europe for about the next 1,200 years or so, although feudalism also developed in other regions of the world, such as Japan. In feudalism, the aristocracy is still a landowning nobility, but the subordinate class of slaves is replaced by a subordinate class of serfs. The relationship between noble and serf is a bit more symbiotic, although clearly one side benefits much more than the other. Nobles now have legal responsibilities to their serfs, and we see the faint outlines of what would come to be nation-states start to form. Feudalism, of course, eventually gives way to the rise of capitalism. We will have much, much more to say about capitalism soon enough, but for the purposes of finishing up this description of the stages of societal development, we can see that capitalism has the following defining features: wage labor, an enshrining of private ownership of the means of production in constitutional documents, and a shift in the goal of economic activity away from simple commodity production for the sake of meeting material needs, toward the production of commodities for the sake of capital expansion and the accumulation of profit. Before moving on, I do want to take a moment to dispel a belief especially common in the United States about the nature of capitalism. If we take capitalist relations of production defined as wage labor, so employer-employee, in the framework of privately owned means of production for the goal of capital expansion and profit, we should note here the glaring absence of any sort of political definitions or the existence of markets as the defining feature of capitalism. We in the U.S. hear all the time that capitalism is freedom and that markets are capitalism. Therefore, the more free the markets are, the more capitalism we have, and the more free we are. This is, in a word, nonsense. Obviously, markets as a medium of exchange of goods and services existed for millennia prior to the onset of capitalism, so markets have nothing to do with whether a system is capitalistic or not. And a wide range of political systems, from actual democracies to authoritarian systems of governance, have operated with a capitalist mode of production. The Scandinavian welfare states with actual, responsive, representative democracy are capitalist, but so was Nazi Germany, Chile under Augusto Pinochet, and South Korea under Syngman Rhee. The point is, the economic mode of production is distinct from the political form in which it operates. Something to think about the next time an American news pundit or politician insists that capitalism is freedom. Moving on. Marx identified as the final stage of human social development the communist mode of production. In a way, the circle is complete under communism. There's no more mechanism of social control or suppression. The tools and resources for meeting human material needs are owned in common, and economic production has shifted focus back to providing the material needs for all members of the community. But unlike before, those tools and resources, and our ability to provide for the material needs of all, are vastly more advanced. We are not talking simple stone hammers here anymore, but instead complex machinery, computers, and modes of transportation that turn the world into one big village. Unironically, the famous series Star Trek has been referred to by many as essentially space communism. Putting aside warp drives and alien civilizations, things that are pure fantasy,
for now,
this description is actually not too far off the mark. If you're not familiar with the show, the premise is that scarcity has been overcome through highly advanced forces of production, so all of people's basic material needs are met, and now the human species is focused on bettering and improving itself for all members, notably through the exploration of space, the final frontier. So, yeah. Space communism is a pretty apt description. Of course, Marx and Engels never actually conceived of such a scientifically advanced society when they talked about socialism or communism. In fact, when they did talk about these concepts, they were famously cagey about what exactly they meant. The only way they ever actually phrased their conception of a communist society, and they were far from the only thinkers to express this idea, was that it would be a moneyless, stateless, classless society where the means of production would be owned in common. In addition to this, to communism has often been applied the pithy description, from each according to ability, to each according to need. This phrase was not invented by Marx. Variations of it had been famous in socialist circles for 100 years by the time it was popularized by Marx in his 1875 Critique of the Gotha Program. But after Marx, it became a rallying slogan for future generations of revolutionaries. But other than that, Marx and Engels never went into too much detail about how it would work. But they did maintain that socialism would be founded on the abundance created by capitalism and embody the ultimate cooperation of the human species toward meeting goals both practical and lofty. One tiny little asterisk I want to put in here is the difference between socialism and communism. These specific terms did not really have distinct meanings until the 20th century. Before that, Marx and Engels used the terms low communism and high communism. Low communism later came to be called socialism and meant the transitory period between capitalism and communism. High communism, then, is what we now just call communism. The differences between socialism and communism will be explored in more detail than I will bet you ever wanted to know through basically the entire series, so please hold all your questions until the end. I've mentioned a handful of times now that a mode of production forms the economic base of society. That base is the first part of Marx's famous formulation, the base superstructure. If the economic base is the mode of production, the totality of the means of production, human labor inputs, and economic relations, the superstructure is all the social and political institutions that grow out of the base. We are talking here about the legal system, political organization, whether that's kings or elected officials like presidents and prime ministers, or self-appointed military generals, even religious institutions. All these institutions arise from the interaction between the forces and the relations of production. But crucially, the superstructure also acts dialectically to reinforce the base. So, for example, a given mode of production will naturally require and give rise to certain laws which both define and reinforce that mode's relations of production. Things like women historically being treated as property, with the aim being control over their reproductive capacities, the legal enforcement of slavery, or the state willing to back up with force, even deadly force if necessary, a piece of paper that says Mr. Smith owns these 10 acres of land, or Mr. Jones owns company XYZ, and therefore they have the right to decide how these means of production are used. These are all examples of the superstructure both growing out of and reinforcing the base. If the economic base requires property rights over other people, or land, or factories, then the superstructure by necessity will make those rights enforceable to perpetuate the base. At this point, I'm going to hand the mic over to Marx so he can provide, in his own words, a very nice summation of what we've laid out thus far. This comes from Marx's Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. Quote, "In the social production of their existence, men inevitably enter into definite relations, which are independent of their will, namely, relations of production appropriate to a given stage in the development of their material forces of production. The totality of these relations of production constitutes the economic structure of society, the real foundation on which arises a legal and political superstructure and to which corresponds definite forms of social consciousness. The mode of production of material life conditions the general process of social, political, and intellectual life. It is not the consciousness of men that determines their existence, but their social existence that determines their consciousness. At a certain stage of development, the material productive forces of society come into conflict with the existing relations of production, or, this merely expresses the same thing in legal terms, with the property relations within the framework of which they have operated hitherto. From forms of development of the productive forces, these relations turn into their fetters. Then begins an era of social revolution. The changes in the economic foundation lead sooner or later to the transformation of the whole immense superstructure." End quote. What Marx is saying here is that each mode of production, from ancient to feudal to capitalist, has a certain role to play in furthering the development of the forces of production. But eventually, as the forces of production develop beyond the existing relations of production, those relations start to hinder the further development of the forces of production. So in level 3 of our flowchart from before, we have friction instead of harmony, and contradictions arise. This leads to social conflict, as the forces of production simply cannot be contained in the existing relations of production. Like Dr. Otto Octavius's fusion experiment from the classic superhero movie Spider-Man 2, the power of the productive forces becomes too great for the magnetic containment field, and they burst asunder in arcs of nuclear energy, which leads to massive explosions, complete with tragic loss of life, and the fusing of giant robotic arms to a new body politic, which Tobey Maguire must then stop from destroying New York City. Oh, something like that. The real point to drive home here is, in a given mode of production, the relations of production act, at first, as catalysts for launching the development of the forces of production further still. But eventually, the momentum is used up, old relations become barriers to be overcome, and new relations are required. The process of overcoming the old and forging the new has a word: revolution. We started this inquiry with two questions. The first was, why socialism? To which we now have the following answer. Marx believed that socialism, and eventually communism, was the ultimate form of economic organization for human society. To support this conclusion, he pointed to all the ways in which prior modes of production had arisen and then fallen. He stressed in particular capitalism's role in developing the forces of production to such an extent that it becomes possible to overcome scarcity and provide for the basic material needs of all, and the ways in which the relations of capitalist production actually hinder achieving this very goal. He posited that the contradictions inherent within the capitalist mode of production, between the forces and the relations of production, would eventually become too significant for the superstructure to contain, and at that point, we would have a socialist revolution. In 21st century America, the examples of this kind of contradiction are numerous. We have such advanced medical technology that things nobody ever thought possible are becoming routine medical procedures. And yet, we have millions of people saddled with billions of dollars of debt trying to access this medicine, with many dying of entirely preventable, curable diseases each year. We have hundreds of thousands of people houseless and hungry, while we throw away millions of tons of food every year and have enough housing stock currently built so that every houseless person could have a place to stay. Thanks to the internet and other IT developments, we have nearly limitless access to information. Yet so much of it is held behind paywalls designed to generate a profit for some individual or company, thereby hindering that knowledge being put to use. Perhaps the greatest contradiction of all is the existential threat to planet-wide organized human life posed by the climate crisis. The existing relations of production have proven utterly incapable of addressing global warming, and are in fact hindering the development of new technologies, read, forces of production, that could actually steer us away from the cliff toward which we are all hurtling. I could go on, but I don't want to belabor the point. I simply wanted to translate these abstract terms we've been discussing into actual, real-life examples. Everywhere we look, we can see that capitalist relations of production, the pursuit of profit and capital accumulation in the name of privately owned means of production, are hampering the further development of the forces of production and the satisfaction of the basic material needs of the population. And sooner or later, something has to give. I'm going to take a short break here to give you, dear listener, a chance to pause, take a break yourself if you need to, and when you're ready, we will start exploring the answer to the second question, why the workers? Just what makes workers in capitalism so special? And why do Marx and Engels, and later Lenin, see them as such a crucial element in the struggle to overcome capitalism? Stay tuned. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. As I am just starting out, I do not yet have Patreon-exclusive material. However, if the Patreon page attracts enough attention, that will definitely change. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. Welcome back. We just finished a condensed overview of historical materialism in order to learn why Marx believed capitalism will give way to communism, and why communism is the final economic mode of production for human society. Now it's time to shift gears to answer our second question, why workers? As we did with the first question, let's rephrase it in a more intelligible manner. Why are the workers the social group which should, indeed is destined to, overthrow capitalism? Here, in contrast to the way I answered the first question, I'm going to provide the answer right away as a roadmap for us to follow, then touch on a few key points of Marx's critique of the capitalist mode of production and the nature of the class divide that is specific and unique to capitalism. The answer is multifaceted. First, the workers, through their own sweat and blood, actually create the material wealth upon which capitalism rests. Second, capitalist production forges these workers into a distinct class, with shared common interests that are directly antagonistic to the continued expansion of capitalist production. And third, as capitalism exhausts itself and enters into crisis, where the relations of production ultimately hinder the further development of the forces of production, there is simply no alternative to the working class as the group capable of making the change. For this part, we're going to summarize a select few points from Marx's Das Kapital, Volume 1. But before we get started, to those listening who have not ever read it, I would strongly encourage you to do so. This summation is going to leave out a lot of juicy, juicy details, so by no means should you take what we're about to discuss as all you need to know. But more importantly, it is a monumentally important work of world literature. Yes, it's considered an intimidating book to read, and it is long in some parts and quite dense, but I would encourage you to have faith in your own abilities to work through the material. Nobody conquers Capital Volume 1 the first time, but they especially don't if they never even try. What's more, there are reading groups everywhere dedicated to reading Marxist and leftist literature, as well as a vast library of YouTube videos discussing the various aspects of the book. For example, the Marxist geographer and professor, David Harvey, has put together an entire video lecture series on Capital, Volumes 1 and 2. In other words, it's never been easier to learn what Marx had to say, in his own words, about the inner workings of capitalism. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. So I encourage you to give it a go. Okay, enough about that. To tackle the first facet, that the workers themselves create the material wealth of society, we're going to start, as Marx did, with the commodity. Marx's definition of a commodity is, quote, an object outside us, a thing that by its very properties satisfies human wants of some sort or another. The nature of such wants, whether, for instance, they spring from the stomach or from fancy, makes no difference, end quote. So this could be anything from an article of clothing, to a smartphone, to a roasted chicken. Commodities have three types of value. There's use value, there's exchange value, and there's intrinsic value. We'll come back to intrinsic value in a moment, but let's first explore use value and exchange value in more detail. The use value is the functionality of the commodity. The coat keeps you warm, the smartphone facilitates communication and accessing information, and the roasted chicken provides dinner. The exchange value is what quantity and quality of other commodities you can obtain by exchanging your commodity for those others. So I can trade you my coat for pairs of boots and mittens, or a smartphone for a stack of books, or whatever. And if ever my coat cannot be exchanged for anything, it ceases to be a commodity. That is, a commodity has both a use value and an exchange value. Crucially, only one of those values can be realized at any given time. I can either use the commodity or I can exchange it. I cannot do both simultaneously. Sure, I can wear the coat and then exchange it, but while I'm wearing it, I'm not exchanging it. And once I exchange it, I can no longer wear it. But there is one commodity which is used as the storehouse of exchange value, money. From chapter 3, quote, "The first chief function of money is to supply commodities with the material for the expression of their values, or to represent their values as magnitudes of the same denomination, qualitatively equal and quantitatively comparable. It thus serves as a universal measure of value," end quote. That is, money allows us to assign values to different commodities so that we can ensure we are exchanging commodities at rough equivalence. Using these two concepts of commodity and money, Marx gives us the following expression of commodity production. Where C is commodity and M is money, the expression C-M-C demonstrates that the most basic economic activity is to exchange commodities you have and don't need for money, which you can then use to acquire commodities you need and don't have. For example, if I am a cobbler, I make 102 pairs of shoes, keep 2 for myself, and what am I to do with the remaining 100 pairs? I go to market to sell them so that I have money. I then use that money to obtain a coat for the winter and chicken for dinner and pay my rent for the month. That is, obtain the things which I didn't or wouldn't have otherwise, but still need. The expression C-M-C was, until the advent of capitalism, the dominant form of commodity production and circulation. What capitalism did was to invert the formula. Under capitalism, it becomes M-C-M. That is, under specifically capitalist production, the capitalist starts with a sum of money, uses it to obtain and produce commodities, and then sells those commodities for money again. Except, as I'm sure you're all wondering, if you are a capitalist, what is the point of that? Using $100 to facilitate the exchange of commodities in order to end up with $100 again is pointless from a capitalist point of view. Nothing really changes except the location of a few commodities. Well, as everybody already knows, capitalists don't just seek money again, they seek more money. The goal of capitalist production is to start with money, use it to obtain or produce commodities, and then sell those commodities for more money than the original sum. So the full expression of capitalist production is actually M-C-M prime, where prime is denoted by an apostrophe to indicate an increase over the original amount. Marx called this increase over the original amount of money surplus value. Where does this surplus value come from? How does $100 magically become $110 just because it somehow produced a commodity? It comes from the human labor that employs the instruments of labor to transform the object of labor into a commodity. The act of weaving wool into a coat is why the coat is more valuable than the wool. The coat is infused with labor, without which the wool can never spontaneously transform into a coat. And this leads us right to the labor theory of value. This theory is not Marx's, and in fact predated his work by several centuries. But Marx absolutely believed it was true and refined it, and it plays a central role in his evaluation of the role of labor in capitalist production. The labor theory of value brings us back to intrinsic value, that third type of value inherent to a commodity. Intrinsic value is independent of the commodity being used or exchanged. According to the labor theory of value, a commodity's intrinsic value is determined by the amount of socially necessary labor required to create the commodity. The term socially necessary labor is absolutely crucial here. It is the amount of labor time performed by a worker of average skill and productivity, working with the average instruments available, to produce a given commodity. The labor theory of value is not about determining what socially necessary labor is. That is, it's not about an individual or a group determining what is necessary to produce. It is about how much socially necessary labor is required to produce any one commodity. Thus, we see that all commodities contain within them the congealed labor of all who provided socially necessary labor to produce them. And to the extent socially necessary labor produces a commodity, the more such labor that is infused into the commodity, the more valuable it is. So as an example, let's say commodity A using the average methods and tools available, takes the average laborer skilled in making it 1 hour to produce one unit. Now let's say that, using the average methods and tools available, commodity B takes the average laborer skilled in making it 10 hours to produce one unit. In relation to commodity A, commodity B has an intrinsic value that is 10 times greater because it represents 10 times the amount of socially necessary labor time used to produce it. But before we move on from this, I want to dispel two common misunderstandings about the labor theory of value. The first one is the difference between value and price. If you're thinking, hey, wait a minute, prices change independently of each other all the time. Commodity B isn't always going to be 10 times more expensive than commodity A. Or sometimes we hear that the value of a commodity is, quote, whatever someone is willing to pay for it. Both of these are essentially making the same point, that prices are not fixed. And to that, I would say, you're absolutely right. Prices fluctuate depending on any number of factors. But we're not talking about price, are we? We're talking about value. These are two separate things. Prices are an expression of the exchange value of a commodity, and depending on what is happening with the market for the commodity in question, prices can change drastically. But values tend not to. For a real-life illustration of the difference between price and value, think about housing. In 2021 and 2022, housing prices in the U.S. were dramatically higher than the value of the houses themselves, due to a number of market conditions, but mostly supply and demand. But if you've ever bought a house, you know that a bank will only lend you the money to cover the actual value of the house, not the price. If you're willing to pay a higher price, that's fine, and that's on you. But the bank knows damn well what the house's value is and is not willing to lend more than that. Price versus value. The second common misunderstanding about the labor theory of value is the mud pie scenario. Often, someone who either is genuinely confused about the labor theory of value or is a bad faith actor trying to muddy the waters, okay, pun intended, will ask, wait, if labor determines value, what if I spend all day making mud pies? Are you saying that because I'm expending my labor on these mud pies, that they are then infused with the value of my labor? But mud pies are worthless. This objection is really just a misunderstanding, or perhaps an intentional misrepresentation, of the labor theory of value. Remember, value is determined by the amount of socially necessary labor required to produce a commodity. Mud pies aren't commodities. They serve no useful purpose in society, so they have no use value. And since they have no use value, nobody is willing to exchange money or another commodity for them, and so they have no exchange value. Since the labor you put into creating mud pies created nothing of value to anyone, it is not socially necessary. So you essentially wasted your day and produced nothing of value. Okay, time to bring all this back to our main query. To recap, a commodity is something that is used to satisfy a need a person has and is or can be exchanged for another commodity. The circuit of capitalist production is M-C-M prime, with the ultimate goal of capitalist production being the obtaining of more money than at the beginning. Capitalist production is focused on only the exchange value of commodities. The use values are incidental, and capitalists only care about making something useful as long as they can sell it. The labor theory of value says that the intrinsic value of a commodity is determined by the amount of socially necessary labor required to produce it. So then M prime, or surplus value, comes from the infusion of labor into the objects of labor, using the instruments of labor to produce a new commodity. And who provides the labor? Human workers. Workers not only create the physical stuff and provide the actual services under capitalist production, their labor power, when engaged in socially necessary labor, literally creates the wealth of society. Facet 1 complete. Now we come to the second facet, that workers are forged into a distinct class with shared interests at odds with the continued expansion of capital. We've already gone over Marx's definition of class, the relationship one group has to the means of production. In capitalism, The two class camps are the class that owns the means of production, the bourgeoisie, and the class that works the means of production, the proletariat. As we discussed previously, class division itself is nothing new, but there are a few key material differences in the classes as constituted under specifically capitalist production that we must recognize. When the mode of production shifted from feudalism to capitalism in different places and times across Europe, effectively, what was happening was this new upstart class of the bourgeoisie successfully challenged the old aristocratic landowning elites, aka the nobility. The bourgeoisie supplanted the nobility as the ruling class and immediately went about changing society to suit its own needs, or, if you like, creating a new superstructure to align with the new base. From the Communist Manifesto, quote, "The bourgeoisie, wherever it has got the upper hand, has put an end to all feudal, patriarchal, idyllic relations. It has pitilessly torn asunder the motley feudal ties that bound man to his natural superiors, and has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest. The bourgeoisie has torn away from the family its sentimental veil, and has reduced the family relation to a mere money relation. Whereas in feudalism, religious institutions were central to communal life, creating a sense of community and purpose, whereas families were close-knit and a bedrock of social organization, when the bourgeoisie came to power, they necessarily abolished these older forms of social organization and replaced them with naked self-interest." End quote. Why does this happen? Why can't the bourgeoisie simply exist and leave the old feudal, patriarchal, idyllic relations in place? Well, if the cycle of capitalist production is M-C-M prime, the accrual of surplus value, or in other words, of profit, becomes the entire goal of production. In pursuit of this goal, capitalism will necessarily seep into every nook and cranny it can to extract the maximum amount of profit possible. Capital flows wherever it can get to, and to whichever business, industry, or market will yield the highest profit margins. So all those lands the church owns that could be used instead to generate profit for the market, all the religious doctrine that encourages people to look toward a spiritual realm for meaning instead of engaging in commodity production and consumption as the ultimate meaning of existence, all those tight-knit communities and family units that help insulate individuals from market forces and provide even slight protection against exploitation by capitalists, they all have to go. Speaking of, now is as good a time as any to go over the concept of exploitation in Marxist theory, since it is usually quite the buzzword. The first thing to note is that when Marx talks about exploitation, he does not mean it in strictly a normative sense. That is, he does not mean it in a morally objectionable way of taking advantage of one's power over another for one's own benefit and treating the other person unfairly. To Marx, exploitation is just cold, hard math. Sadly, however, Marx's incredibly thorough analysis of exploitation does not lend itself to pithy summaries or quotes. So instead, I'm going to give you my own brief example. Imagine you work in a shoe factory, and every day, day after day, you produce 100 pairs of shoes. Now imagine that in order for you to be able to afford food and pay your rent, so that you can come back in the next day, you require at least the equivalent of the cost of 50 pairs of shoes. Each day, which your boss pays you. These 50 pairs of shoes are the cost to the boss of your labor, and it is, in a way, a non-negotiable cost. Your employer, at the very least, has to pay you enough so that you don't starve to death and can come in the next day to make your 100 pairs of shoes for him. It is required in order to reproduce your labor on a daily basis. But of course, you're asking yourself, wait, what happens to the other 50 pairs of shoes I make each day? Well, wouldn't you know it, your employer has put as a condition of your working in his factory and earning your daily bread that you make 100 pairs of shoes each day, and that they all belong to him. He pays you the cash equivalent of 50 pairs of shoes, which he makes up when he sells them later, so that you can come back tomorrow. But the cash he gets for the other 50 pairs of shoes goes into his pocket. That is exploitation. It is the ratio of the total amount of value created by labor to the amount of that value the laborer keeps as part of her or his wages. Whether you create $1,000 a day or $10,000 a day of total value, unless you are paid the full amount you create each day in your wages, you are exploited. In fact, if you create $1,000 a day of total value and are allowed to keep $800 a day, your rate of exploitation is actually less than your friend who creates $10,000 a day of total value but is only allowed to keep $2,000 a day. Even though your friend pockets more money in raw dollars, they control only 20% of whatever it is they produce, whereas you control 80%. Now, to the average person, this kind of material exploitation is immediately recognizable as unfair, which is why in common public discourse, the term exploitation is spoken of in terms of being unfair and morally objectionable. But the capitalist doesn't care. In a capitalist enterprise, there's simply no other way to make profit. Think about it. If the capitalist paid you the full value of what you produced, what would be in it for him? What would even be the point? How would he come up with his M prime? Of course, in the real world, it's more complex, and individual results do vary. First of all, we have not even mentioned the impact of division of labor on the production of commodities. Adam Smith was actually the first to famously use the example of the production of pins in an industrial assembly line as proof of the increased labor productivity that was to be gained by division of labor. Instead of having each worker individually make pins all day, the daily yield of pin production could be vastly multiplied if individual workers focused on just one aspect of making the pin, like drawing the wire, making the pin head, and attaching the head to the wire. By the end of the day, the boxes and boxes of pins that have been produced is inarguably more than the workers could have made if they had made each pin individually. However, none of the workers can point to any one pin and say, "I made that." They can only point, as a group, to the pins, as a whole, and say, "We made that." So the production process of commodities is socialized. But the profits from said production? Well, those are, of course, privatized. We often hear as rationalization for this that the owner deserves to control the profit because it was their idea or they took the risk in starting the business. To take the first one, while intellectual labor definitely needs to be respected and rewarded, it must be pointed out that an idea alone has no value. It must be able to be turned into a reality in some form or another, as a new business or even as a form of art. How much would you pay for an idea of a perpetual motion machine if you knew it could never be built? And so again, we are faced with the fact that production is socialized. One individual, or even relative few individuals, come up with the ideas, while large numbers of workers are the ones who actually realize the value of those ideas. It's not that the owner does not deserve to be rewarded for coming up with a good idea. But do they really deserve to control, in perpetuity, all the surplus value that all the workers produced, turning that idea into a reality? As for risk, business owners are not the only people in a business taking risks. Workers take risks all the time, and the types and severities of risks they take vary vastly across industries. Many risk their lives and limbs, literally. Think about all the disfigured factory workers of the 19th century. Or hell, think of factory workers still now today. But we don't even need to take that extreme of an example. Workers often move for jobs. They take out mortgages and car loans based on the expectation of their salary. All of this can be very risky because they might lose that job and salary, whether they are fired or the business goes under because the people running it make poor decisions that impact the entire company. It's not that the business owner does not take risks in setting up their business. It's just that the owner is not the only one taking a risk. And if we're going to use risk as a benchmark for who gets to control the surplus value the business produces and who gets paid more, well, fair's fair, right? But okay, even given that business owners are ultimately the ones who control the surplus value under capitalism, it's still not as cut and dry as all that. In times of high unemployment, when workers have few if any other viable options for employment, Bosses and companies can really put the screws to them, slashing wages or cutting benefits or demanding longer hours be worked or more work be done within the same amount of time, all in order to extract more and more surplus value. In times of low unemployment, the power dynamic is reversed, and workers can start making demands that usually bosses will have no choice but to meet, such as higher overall wages, more time off, and better working conditions. Some, lucky few, really like their jobs, and so it doesn't feel like they're being exploited. Some very lucky few actually possess skill sets that are so rare and valuable that they can basically name their price, or can be compensated for their labor so handsomely that they can live whatever lives they want. And of course, the business owner does not simply pocket all that surplus value himself. He has to pay for the raw materials and other inputs, transportation of commodities to markets, maintain and replace machines and equipment, pay for the buildings, and so on. But none of that changes the simple fact that, as a system, capitalism runs on the exploitation of labor. The bourgeoisie, as a class, pays the proletariat, as a class, only a portion of the value which the proletariat produces for the bourgeoisie, keeping the rest as surplus value to achieve the maximum M prime possible. But what really forges the proletariat into a distinct class with its own set of interests is the fact that the workers are people. And people have families and material needs. We need to care for our young and elderly, to see the doctor when we are sick, and to maintain a household. We need time to go on vacation, listen to music, dance, laugh, and make love. As much as capitalist production may try to reduce our labor to just another input, another raw material to be used up, and thereby turn us, the people in whom this labor resides, into just another cog in their industrial machinery, we are not cogs, and we never will be. We are rational thinkers, capable of understanding the reality of our situation. When we work together in groups, in factories and offices and warehouses, we are together, collectively, creating far more value than we can as individuals. And we watch as the fruits of our labor are forcibly handed over to the bosses. Oh, and also, we talk. We talk to each other, at work and after work, with colleagues who work with us, and with friends who work other jobs. And sometimes, if we talk long enough, we can recognize that we are, all of us, getting a raw deal. That we could do the jobs we are doing way better than our bosses tell us how to do them. And that we could use the surplus value we create for better things than mansions and yachts and private jets. Things like healthcare and housing and education. But what really spooks the bosses is when we are done talking. What really spooks them is when we decide to do something about the current state of affairs. Okay, let's connect all this back to the second facet of our answer. Once again, I want to let Marx speak for himself from the Communist Manifesto. Quote, "The essential condition for the existence and for the sway of the bourgeois class is the formation and augmentation of capital. The condition for capital is wage labor. Wage labor rests exclusively on competition between the laborers. The advance of industry, whose involuntary promoter is the bourgeoisie, replaces the isolation of the laborers, due to competition, by their revolutionary combination, due to association. The development of modern industry, therefore, cuts from under its feet the very foundation on which the bourgeoisie produces and appropriates products. What the bourgeoisie therefore produces, above all, are its own gravediggers. Its fall and the victory of the proletariat are equally inevitable." End quote. This speaks to everything we've gone over so far. Under capitalism, the two opposing classes are the bourgeoisie as the owners of the means of production, and the proletariat as the owners of their labor. The bourgeoisie, as the stewards of this new capitalism, are forced by the cycle of M-C-M prime to find new and inventive ways to extract surplus value from every nook and cranny. Surplus value is extracted through exploitation, or the appropriation of larger and larger percentages of what the proletariat produces. The workers are brought together in order to perform their labor, and this affords them the opportunity to talk with each other and realize that they share the common goal of overthrowing the bourgeoisie, putting an end to their own exploitation, and taking control again of their own labor. This is what Marx means by the bourgeoisie produces its own gravediggers. They need workers and are powerless without labor. Yet that power of labor over them is what will eventually sweep away the bourgeoisie as a class. The final facet of our answer, that when it comes time for the bourgeoisie to be overthrown at the end of capitalism, the workers are the only ones left to take over, is now pretty self-evident. They are a distinct, unified class that is physically responsible, as a group, for the production of the wealth of society. The only wrinkle left to iron out is the question of the peasantry. This question is of little relevance to us in the 21st century, but it is actually quite influential on the Russian Revolution and the early Soviet period, so we should discuss it now. Marx rejected the idea that peasant farmers would, or even could, be the standard bearers of socialism and communism for two main reasons. First, their productive role in society was crucial, but left them geographically too dispersed. Industrial production required people to be physically in the same place at the same time, working together, and it was specifically this aspect of production that endowed the workers with the class consciousness necessary to challenge capitalism. Peasants, by contrast, did work together, but usually in small groups and spread out over large swaths of land, which prevented class consciousness from spreading. And second, the peasantry did not necessarily have any shared interests in overthrowing capitalism. Many of them were landowners, with at least a modicum of control over their own personal means of production, with tools, livestock, etc. If anything, peasants wanted only to improve their own lot within capitalism. The following quote from Marx comes from another of his classic works, the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. Quote, "The smallholding peasants form an enormous mass whose members live in similar conditions but without entering into manifold relations with each other. Their mode of production isolates them from one another instead of bringing them into mutual intercourse. The isolation is furthered by France's poor means of communication and the poverty of the peasants. Their field of production, the smallholding, permits no division of labor in its cultivation, no application of science, and therefore no multifariousness of development, no diversity of talent, no wealth of social relationships. Each individual peasant family is almost self-sufficient, directly produces most of its consumer needs, and thus acquires its means of life more through an exchange with nature than an intercourse with society. A small holding, the peasant and his family. Beside it, another small holding, another peasant, and another family. A few score of these constitute a village, and a few score villages constitute a department. Thus, the great mass of the French nation is formed by the simple addition of homologous magnitudes, much as potatoes in a sack form a sack of potatoes. Insofar as millions of families live under conditions of existence that separate their mode of life, their interests, and their culture from those of the other classes, and put them in hostile opposition to the latter, they form a class. Insofar as there is merely a local interconnection among these small-holding peasants, and the identity of their interests forms no community, no national bond, and no political organization among them, they do not constitute a class." End quote. But the workers, as we have seen, are different. And as the capitalist mode of production expands, it engulfs more and more people around the world, inducting them into the ranks of the proletariat. And it's not just the industrial workers in countries like the US, Britain, Germany, and Russia. Capitalism is a global system, so workers in Bangladesh, Kenya, Brazil, and every place in between are also proletarians. If we ever gain the understanding of how this system works, and that workers around the world all have more in common with each other than with their bosses, we will gain the class consciousness necessary to unite and finally challenge the control to which we are all subjected, every single day, all over planet Earth. Which is why Marx and Engels' immortal call to action rings true still. Quote, "Let the ruling classes tremble at a communistic revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. Workers of the world, unite." End quote. I hope you've enjoyed this all-too-brief summation of some of the communist ideals on which Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels based their worldview, and on which the Soviet Union was later founded. And if you've made it this far, thank you for listening. I aim to make this and the next episode on Leninism the most theory-dense for a good long while, so please don't think every episode will be like this. But as I said in the beginning, if we're going to understand the complex history of the Soviet Union, we need to at least know what they were trying to do. And I do hope you'll join me next time, because Karl Marx left us with a call to action, a blueprint for how our current economic system works, and a few signposts pointing toward how he thought that economic system might be changed or overcome. However, he left it to his successors to actually put that call to action into action. And so next episode, we will be exploring the main ideas of one of Marx's most famous successors, and the man perhaps most responsible for the first successful proletarian revolution in human history, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. Thank you so much for listening. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a Socialist History of the Soviet Union. До свидания.